In the meantime, Ellen's father had extracted Frank from the group. "Ellen's already told me that you wish to speak to me. Let's not make it too formal." They disappeared, and I went off to the phone box around the corner. When I got through, I gave a false name. After a long wait, somebody at the police station finally found the information that the exit visa regulation would take effect from the following Tuesday. I said, "Many thanks," and hung up, very pleased. When I came back, the room I had left was almost empty. There was only an old man sitting in a corner. Maybe he had been there all along, silent and unnoticed. Perhaps he was a grandfather. He looked like one of the old Jews in Rembrandt's paintings. He had a little pointed beard and wrinkles all over his face. He sat in a large chair and very calmly smoked a pipe, visibly deep in thought. The others must have gone to some other room in this rambling house. I wanted to ask where they were, but before I could put my question, the old man addressed me. His little, deep-seated, clear eyes were directed straight at me. "You don't appear to be a Jew," he said. And when I explained that I had accompanied a Jewish friend, he said with great authority, "It is good that you stand by your friend." I became rather embarrassed and stammered something, but I was even more bemused when he continued, "It is also wise of you. Did you know that?" He seemed to enjoy my uneasiness. He sucked slowly at his pipe and then announced with an old, rusty, but still strong voice, "The Jews will survive this, don't you agree? Oh, you needn't worry, they will. Many others have sought to eradicate the Jews. The Jews have outlived them all. They will outlive this as well, and then they will remember. Have you heard of Nebuchadnezzar?"
"The Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible?" I asked doubtfully.
"Just so," the grandfather said. He regarded me with a spark of sarcasm in his little eyes. "He wanted to eradicate the Jews, and he was a greater man than your Herr Hitler, and his empire was greater than the German Reich, and the Jews were younger then, younger and weaker, and they had less experience. He was a great man, Nebuchadnezzar, a clever man and a cruel man." He spoke slowly, as if he were preaching. He relished his speech and took solemn, slow puffs at his pipe between the sentences. I listened politely. "But the great King Nebuchadnezzar did not succeed," he continued. "In spite of all his greatness and all his cleverness and all his cruelty, he is so forgotten that you smile when I mention his name. Only the Jews remember him, and they are still here and alive. And here comes this Herr Hitler, and wants to eradicate them again. He won't succeed either, this Herr Hitler. Don't you believe me?"
"I sincerely hope you're right," I said modestly.
"Let me tell you something," he said. "A little trick, one of God's little tricks, if you wish. Those men that persecute the Jews always suffer misfortune. Why is that so? How should I know? I don't know why, but it is a fact." As I tried to rack my brain for historical examples and counterexamples, he continued, "Consider the great King Nebuchadnezzar. He was a great man in his time, king of kings, a great, great man. But in old age he went mad, and he went on all fours in the fields like a cow, and chewed grass with his teeth like a cow." He broke off for a puff at his pipe, then a little smile appeared on his face, a smile of inner mirth. And his eyes sparkled, as though he had just had a really funny and heart-warming thought. "Perhaps," he said, "perhaps Herr Hitler will one day go on all fours in the fields, eating grass like a cow. You are young, you may experience it yet. I won't." Suddenly he broke into irresistible laughter at his image. His entire frame shook as he chuckled silently, until he choked a little on the smoke from his pipe and started coughing. Just then, Ellen's mother looked in at the door.
"Well?" she asked anxiously, and I gave my good news, for which she thanked me effusively. "Now you must drink a glass to the health of the young couple," she said, and she pulled me away. "You know all about it?"
I made a bow to the old man as I left, and he dismissed me, still amused, with a dignified nod of his head. In another room, all the assembled involuntary engagement guests stood around and, with anxious faces, drank wine or held glasses in their hands.
Frank and Ellen stood among them, accepting their congratulations. They looked neither happy nor unhappy. It was a strange engagement party. My news that they had 2 days free to escape the country was just the right engagement present. However, it made some of the guests uneasy, and they started to talk of leaving. Half an hour later, I was on the train again with Frank. Night had fallen, and the rain had become steady. Our compartment was empty. Now, at last, for the first time that day, we really had a chance to talk, but we were silent. Suddenly he said, "What do you think of all this? You haven't said anything yet. Am I doing the right thing?" "I don't know," I said. "It's certainly right for you to leave tomorrow. I only wish I could go too." "I had to tie up all the loose ends," he said, as though I had rebuked him. "Do you understand? I couldn't go with all these half-finished, undecided things left hanging. So now I'm engaged to Ellen, and she's coming with me, and it's all tidy." I nodded. "Are you pleased?" I asked. "I don't know," he said. After a while he laughed and said, "Maybe it's all complete nonsense. I don't know. It happened so quickly." "Are you going to see Hanni now?" I said. "Yes," he said, and then putting his hand on my arm with sudden warmth, "would you do me a real favour? Please stay in touch with Hanni. Phone her in the next few days and comfort her a little, if you can. Tell her... No, don't tell her anything. But comfort her a little, if you can, and..." He continued, and he became more eager and warmer than he had been all day. "Try and help her a bit with her passport troubles. She has no passport. It's a dreadful muddle because she doesn't have a proper nationality. She was born somewhere that was Hungarian at the time, but now belongs to Czechoslovakia. Her father died in 1920. Nobody knows if he opted for a nationality or which he opted for if he did. Now neither Hungary nor Czechoslovakia will give her a passport. It's dreadfully complicated." "Of course," I said. "I'll see what I can do." Comforting. "Well, I'll try." "Yes," he said. "That will be difficult." Silence fell again, and the train carried us through the night and rain. Suddenly he said, "Maybe if Hanni had had a passport, it would all be quite different now." We arrived at Zoo Station and got out. For the first time one saw something of the revolution, in a negative way, to be sure. The usually bright, sparkling streets of the amusement area around the zoo were dead and deserted, as I had never seen them before. We waited at a phone box. He was already impatient. The time for phoning Hanni had already passed. "Hanni next," he said thoughtfully, "then my father, then packing. Thanks anyway for all your help." "Have a safe journey," I said to him. "Just get through this night. Tomorrow it will all be behind you, and you will be out." Only at that moment did I fully grasp that this was a parting. Perhaps there would have been a lot more to say, but it was too late. The telephone box became available, so we shook hands and said goodbye.